And good morning, welcome to Life Matters. Natasha Mitchell, continuing your morning with RN. Great to have your company. Oh, and a heads up, yesterday saw the launch of the ABC's Mental Health Initiative. In the lead up to Mental Health Week in October, an extravaganza coming your way. It's called Mental As. Think mental as anything. I'm one of the official ambassadors, but we can all be ambassadors for good mental health. Find out more at abc.net.au/mentalas. Life Matters is going to be jumping on board too with an exercise challenge in September. Stay posted for more on that. The interest on our Facebook page in participating is very exciting for us, I have to say. And also coming up on the show today, imagine a world where we all communicated perfectly. We heard each other. Yeah, utopia, I know. But a setting where that actually is vital is in hospitals. Is theatre the way to get that into the heads and hearts of health workers? First up this morning, we want to take your calls on this too. If you're between 15 and 24, the news on youth unemployment last week may be very close to the bone. At just over 14%, it's at a 13-year high now. Young people now account for one in three of unemployed Australians. We want to look at one aspect of what really are a complex array of reasons for this figure, and we're taking your calls. Are we shutting young people out of the workforce by not encouraging them to do paid work in their teens? For me, it started with paper rounds at around 13, and then I got a checkout job at a department store at 14. What did you do? Are young people missing out on that vital early work experience now? And why would that be? Give us a call, 1300 225 76. Joining me is Peter Koronica. He's a Melbourne restaurateur, a youth mentor, and a parent. He's employed more than 1,000 young people in the last 25 years, so he knows some stuff. He's just released a book, Your Boss's Boots, How to Get Your Foot Through the Door in the Competitive World of Work. It's a real wake-up call for young people, but also for parents, because he thinks that you play a pivotal role in stemming the rise of youth unemployment. Welcome to the program, Peter.
Good morning, Natasha.
And urging you to get on the phones now and be part of this discussion. Listeners, is your son or daughter under 24 and unemployed? Are you wondering why they can't get work? Do you ever blame yourself? Did you get paid work in your teens? How vital do you think that is? And what did you do? If you're under 24 and unemployed, has it been hard to get that early work experience you need? Why? Or if you are unemployed, what made all the difference, do you think? If you are employed, beg your pardon, and under 24, what made all the difference, do you think? 1300 225 76. If you're in WA, Northern Territory and South Australia, head to our listener line, 02 833 1430. Or you can text us this morning if that's easier for you, 0418 226 576. Back to you, Peter. Good morning again.
Good morning, Natasha. Thank you. I jumped in a little bit earlier.
No. I confused you. I got a bit confused at the top. I'm very sad about Robin Williams' death, the actor.
Yeah, that stunned me. I found out 1 minute ago when you mentioned it.
Very shocking. Absolutely. Now, you've got a tough call in this book. You're making a tough call to parents of teenagers. Get them off the sporting field, out of their music classes, and into part-time jobs. Why?
Yeah, look, you've summed it up in a nutshell. Why? Look, the answer is the day young people turn 20, they're the same price as a 40-year-old. And the Fair Work Act stipulates that. So what we have now in Australia, we have this growing trend to educate to 18, 20, 22 years of age. And that education's a great thing. But these young people are missing out on core workplace skills. So they're coming into the workforce with education and few skills, but they're coming in at the same price as, say, a 40-year-old skilled adult with 20 years experience. And these are the people that they're having to compete with. So starting work young at 14 and 15 years of age is the key.
Mm. But, you know, parents and young people can feel like they're in a bit of a rock and a hard place because, of course, there's the pressure of schoolwork. Good results are seen as a critical basic requirement now. So parents might feel quite reluctant about pushing their son or daughter into the workforce while they're at school.
Yeah, look, absolutely. And it's challenging. And look, in a competitive workforce, it's a natural instinct of parents to do that. But let's remember that in the GFC in the last 6 years in the US, parents did exactly that. Their theory was, well, why should my son or daughter serve pizza slices? What good is it in that? When in fact that they need to get good grades. And what we've found in the US when we've looked into it is that now only 1 in 5 graduates get a full-time paid position, and the ones that are getting work are the ones that worked part-time while they're studying. And that's my core message in the book, is build a parallel pathway.
A parallel pathway. What are the parallel pathways?
Well, it's about recognising your educational goals and matching work experience that will meet the needs of a future employer. And, of course, that all starts with a plan. It's about building a plan, career planning, from as young as 12 and 13.
Now, come on, 12 or 13, what kids are going to be planning a career at that age? Or is this just about getting them out of the home, away from just the pocket money work in the house, and into another environment? Is that what you're arguing?
Look, a little bit. I think we have to recognise that, look, to sum this up quickly, we have to recognise that this problem is all about prevention, and it's a 10-year plan from unemployed to dream job. Mm. In Germany and Switzerland, two countries with the world's lowest youth unemployment rates, that's when career planning begins. It begins at 12 and 13 years of age, and this is where parents step in. You can spot the abilities, the strengths in your child by this age. My son is 11. He's beginning to code. At 9, he hacked Minecraft. And at 4, he was doing 100-piece puzzles. And I know cybersecurity specialist, I know big data analytics, I know his computer skills will be valued by employers in the labour market in the future.
That's okay, but some parents will be listening and going, We can work all our lives. What about being a kid? And I've met parents. I mean, this is a vital issue, I think, because I've met kids in their 20s, or young people in their 20s, into their 30s, that are really struggling with building a CV because they didn't start early. But on the other hand, I've met parents who say, look, I want my kids to have a childhood.
Yeah, look, it's tough, and I agree with them. I've got a 9 and 11-year-old. I'm watching them grow up. But what we're seeing now is a growing number of young 20-year-olds who are stressed, who are confused, and who never had a plan in the first place. And worst of all, the labour market's not meeting their expectations. And the research we've done in Germany and Switzerland is we've found that 60 to 70% of youth are working with an employer by the age of 16. And the end result is that these kids are happy. They're not stressed. They're actually relaxed because they've found their way. And by 15 years of age, young people are on the trajectory where their skill sets are. It's just a matter of parents recognising it and matching it to the needs that are demanded in many industries throughout the labour market.
Yes, and I wonder whether young people's expectations of entry-level work sometimes is a bit too high. Let's come back to that, and I want to come back to your story too, but I'd like to take some calls because we've got a full board already here on Life Matters. Talking about young people and work, how vital is it to get paid work experience outside of the home in your teens, given what we're seeing with the rise of youth unemployment in Australia right now? It's a 13-year high. Ali in Victoria, now, you're a 21-year-old.
Yes.
And what's your concern here?
I think, he mentioned a good point just before about, you know, the expectations of entry-level work, you know, not meeting their expectations. And I think that, like, definitely goes to the point that I was going to make, that a lot of my friends, they just don't want to work. Mum and Dad will support them. Both of my brothers are long-term unemployed, you know, because it's too comfortable. There's maybe out of my 10 friends, you know, only one of them's unemployed and doesn't study. But most of them study, you know, maybe, you know, like I said, you know, 75% or 100% workload, but don't have any employment after that. You know, and I have a friend that's just graduated, from Monash with, you know, very, you know, a great degree, but she's never worked a day in her life and she can't get a job.
Yeah. What about you?
Well, yeah, no, I've worked every day of my life since I turned 15. Like, my parents were, for some reason, a bit better with me than maybe, and not so hard on my brothers.
And your brothers, that's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, look, you know, and I've worked every day. You know, I have a great career. You know, I work for one of the Australia's largest law firms with, you know, not just as a paralegal, you know, as a, in a skilled job. And, you know, and I study full time, and I'm, you know, and I also have a 3-year-old, so And, you know, I go to uni, I see all my friends, you know, complaining about how they can't get work, but they don't want to, you know, they don't want to flip burgers. And it's just, it's almost insulting to the people who do, like, who do work hard. You know, like, I've, everything I have is because I've worked as hard as I possibly can. And then people, you know, it's just expect to sit back and take the easy road and get the same result.
Geez, you've done a lot by 21. Got a three-year-old working in a law firm. Hello. Thank you very much for the...
And study full-time.
And you study full-time. How is this possible? Do you sleep? Look, Ali, thank you. That's a very strong call and you make very strong points about your peers. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
David in New South Wales, you've had jobs since you were 12. You don't think it helped you in the long term, though?
Yes, I don't disagree with your expert. I'm actually an accounting graduate and... I actually, my early years in my accounting career, I struggled with the transition to that sort of work. But, you know, as a youngster, I had jobs as a paper boy and a chemist boy and then in retail. But I just found that you're always a second-class citizen and, you know, you were subject to bullying and that sort of thing. So I don't think it helped me at all. But if I had, had traineeships in accounting as an accountant or a junior, that may well have helped.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting point that, and I'll come back to Peter on that. Thanks for the call, David.
Yeah, thank you.
Yep. Jill in Sydney, your point is not enough jobs for young people now.
No, this...
And someone else has tweeted us, texted us, for young people currently there is almost no work. Are there even jobs for them if they want it? So that's the point you'd like to make.
Exactly. There are just too many kids looking for too few jobs. I had four children. They all worked through high school. They all got jobs. They're great. They're now parents of 20-year-olds. All of those kids have had part-time jobs while they've been going through. They're all working now, except the one and only university student. And he's a graduate. He's now doing a second degree. He had various jobs on the way through. It's taken him 11 months to get the job, the part-time job he has now, while he studies. As for telling them give up sport, that's mad. They should all be doing a sport on the weekend. There's plenty of other time. There's Thursday nights, there's Saturdays, Sundays. There's lots of times. The problem is there are not enough jobs. There are too many kids looking for them. And to keep telling these kids, you're lazy, you're not trying. Of course there's a few of those. There'll always be a few of those. But there's a lot of good kids out there trying really hard. And they get depressed. They keep, even like looking for full-time jobs, you know, let alone when you're a student looking for something. You know, we've just got to be a bit easy on them. I shudder to think what's going to happen when this 6 months without any pay comes in.
Under the new start arrangements for under 30-year-olds.
It's scandalous. Why aren't we walking in the streets with banners? These kids need help. They don't all come from happy homes. And many of them come from homes where the parents aren't even working.
Jill, thank you. You make very strong points there. Appreciate the call. And we've also received a text message. I think this guy is overblowing things utterly. Peter, I'm reading this to you. The job you have at 15 or 20 shouldn't be the job you have at 30. That's not how the world works anymore. And on Twitter, Emily has tweeted, turning kids into commodities for market. He also needs a reality check about working hours and practicality. So people are pushing back a little, Peter. Koronika.
Yeah, look, it's a complex set of issues. There's no doubt about it. The Graduate Careers Survey came out last week and it made it very clear that the graduates who did achieve a full-time position were the ones that were working part-time. And it's about meeting an employer's expectations. It's not about flipping burgers. It's about recognising that the world of work is an education unlike what you get at school. And it's an education in communication, in sales, multitasking and many other core skills which are portable across industries. And that's why you have to get to work young. And that's why we're finding, and our first caller mentioned it, you're finding people in their early 20s who are struggling to get work because they haven't worked at all. Employing people in Australia is a risk. And employers need to mitigate their risk. And how do they do that? They look at the CV, they look for work experience, and they look for people that they know that won't let them down. That's why you need to work from 15.
Do you not see, though, that during the teen years, things like sporting clubs can play a vital role in building some of those very skills that you're pointing out?
Yeah, look, and I respect the last caller and her call about the sport. Look, sport's a really important thing. And I was talking on 3RW Friday afternoon and I said my kids had five sports to go to in 24 hours.
Oh, man.
So, yeah, so look, I'm there on it. It's just not as important as work.
As work.
That's my core message. My key message is you have to study and you have to work. They're the two priorities. Third comes sport and maybe music, maybe other interests. But understand, and I said this to 2UE on Friday, employers don't ask how many goals you kicked at an interview.
Sure.
They
we're not on 2UE, we're on Radio National right now. And Peter Koronica is my guest. He's a restaurateur, a youth mentor. He's the author of Your Boss's Boots, How to Get Your Foot Through the Door in the Competitive World of Work. And we are talking about whether or not it's vital for young people to get paid work experience during their teens, and are they getting less of that now, and why would that be? Peter, your own story is interesting too. You're the son of an Italian migrant father, but what was your first job?
A chemist round, collecting golf balls in the river at the local golf course in bare feet. Then we used to sell them back to the golfers. And then, of course, I was working at Coles making donuts, and then a Melbourne restaurant chain where I began to cut my teeth for 7 years.
So, and how old were you when you started out?
I was probably 11 or 12 years of age.
Yeah, likewise. You were a shy teenager too, weren't you?
I was very much a shy teenager. And what I found when I started work is that it brought me out of my shell. And I make it clear in the book that I wrote is that part-time work saved me. Education wasn't for me, and I had to repeat Year 11, and I struggled. And without the workforce education that I got when I was young, this environment exposed what I was good at. And school often doesn't do that. And the working world, and that's why I bring this point home, the working world sometimes is for people to expose where their strengths and abilities are. That's the great thing about it.
Now, we'll come back to some of the challenges that you see young people facing in getting into the workforce early on. Let's take some more calls. Lisa in Victoria. Now, you work on a government program for work experience. What do you mean?
We connect with employers and schools and to create workplace opportunities for students while they're in secondary school. And what we find is it's beneficial to both parties. So it's really beneficial to employers and it's really beneficial to students. In terms of some of the benefits to employers regarding workforce development, it really assists them, even creating opportunities for, you know, future employees and to mentor students and to sort of test the waters as to what's out there in terms of young people and their skills. In terms of the young people, the benefits are amazing. You know, it helps them just firstly sort of what Peter was talking about before in terms of what it's like, the expectations of just working in terms of teamwork and communication, in terms of turning up on time, in terms of acting professionally,
yes,
in terms of not having your mobile phone out there texting while you're working. You know, just those little things that students, you know, a lot of students don't really know about unless they've had that experience.
Good point. Thank you very much, Lisa. Appreciate it for the call. And Claire in Queensland, good morning to you. Five kids in a coastal town, all worked in your teens. Is that you or your children?
No, my children, let me say though that they were pretty fortunate because my husband and I have a small business and we've always worked at markets. So I guess they started off, you know, around markets and meeting people and talking with people. So they've always had a really good sense of themselves. And as they got a bit older, they worked around the town in ice cream shops and all over the place, really, and backpackers. So they've had a really good look into the whole work.
So was that also about local businesses understanding the potential of young employees with no work experience initially?
Look, probably. I guess, you know, towns like this really run on tourism. So, and kids are always looking for a bit of extra money and, you know, so. But having said that, kids aren't very loyal sometimes, so they'll start and then they'll stop. But you know, it's all part of it, really. But they just had a great grounding in how to speak with people, how to deal with the general public, you know.
Thanks, Claire.
And also, can I just say that sometimes it's not what you know, it's who you know. And four of them have since moved to Melbourne and virtually all of them have got some work through someone they know or their cousins or whatever. So So that makes a big difference as well.
Yeah, working your networks, and I think that's a very strong point that Peter makes. Going back to Peter Koronika now, Peter, where do you want young people to start? Where do you want them to start? I mean, this idea of networking early on, you know, getting out there with a CV, walking the streets, door knocking. I mean, you know, some people say that, well, I've done that, and still no one was receptive.
Yeah, look, I think the first thing to do as parents is, and this is a real key point, and the last caller brought it up about the networks when they've come to Melbourne, is what I call build a network tree. So mum and dad sit at home and make this giant tree of every single person that you know, mums and dads, what they do for a living and a contact point, and mark in it what industry that they're in. Then the next step is for the individual, you know, who has an interest in, say, a particular industry, is just to go and sit down and have a cup of coffee with this person, find out what's moving and shaking in that industry, and whether any potential opportunities, are there for the taking. Now, Richard Bowles, in his book, What Colour Is Your Parachute, an amazing career author from the US, he wrote this book in 1971 and it keeps getting republished. He claims that 7% of jobs are won through the internet, the interview process, and 40% of jobs are won through networking. And I believe it. And you can see that, you know, you can see that young people who teach themselves how to present themselves really quickly, face-to-face, stand a greater chance than just a CV being popped through on email.
That's an extraordinary figure, isn't it? That 77% through interview, 40% game through networking. There are some key barriers, though, for young people, aren't there? It's not just will. A lot of young people have a lot of will to work, and the work just might not be there.
Yeah, look, it's a complex set of issues, and you've read the book, and it's all pretty much spelled out there. Look, the GFC gave big business the permission almost to outsource labour at a cheaper rate to foreign countries. We're in a situation where business life cycles are so much shorter today, so employers seek skilled staff, and the internet gives them the luxury to do that.
Yeah.
Small business, the country's major employer, has a problem, and that is they can't pay their tax. And a new figure out last week finds that 78% of small business owners have outstanding debts with the Australian Tax Office. And the country's major employer can't, and we're not talking personal income tax here, we're talking their PAYG, we're talking their business activity statements, their GST. So what we're finding is that small business owners are less likely to invest, and young people are an investment. They're like sorry to use the analogy, but like a pizza oven or a delivery van. You need to invest in your business to make it grow, whereas now we're finding that employers simply are looking for skilled labour that can get the job done now.
Well, where does that leave young people then?
Yeah, and this is the challenge.
For those entry-level jobs.
Yeah, jobs. And this is my point. Get in at 15 and 16 when you're 50 to 60% of the adult wage rate. That's the key, because that gives employers incentive to hire you, incentive to train you, and it builds core workplace skills that are portable across all industries. That's what it's about. It's not just about serving coffee and waiting tables. You're learning skills that you carry with you for life, just like I'm doing right now here on the radio. I learnt these skills waiting tables.
Yeah.
That's the most important thing of all.
Peter Koronika is my guest this morning. He's a restaurateur and a youth mentor. He's written a book, Your Boss's Boots, How to Get Your Foot Through the Door in the Competitive World of Work. Very practical. And we are particularly focused on this whole issue of getting work experience, paid work experience, early on in your teens. Moira, in New South Wales,
yes.
Your sense is that the problem doesn't lie with the lack of jobs. Is that right?
Well, yes, not totally with the lack of jobs. I feel that there's a lot of qualified young people out there, especially through university, getting a qualification. They're working hard to achieve that, but it's not work-oriented. It doesn't lead them automatically to a job. I don't think they're well-informed about that, and I see a huge gap there that they spent all this time and then get out, and then I heard some of your listeners saying 11 months before I got a position, you know. That must be very disheartening.
Yes, thanks, Moira. Peter, this is a point that you make very strongly in your book about the value of tertiary level education and thinking strategically about what you choose to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, it's all about a plan.
Because you don't do tertiary education just for employment. You do it for personal development, enrichment, intellectual growth. There's all that too.
Yeah, look, there's lots of non-workplace benefits to tertiary education. But the problem going forward is that it's expensive. And we have 1.7 million Australians with a higher education loan debt, and this isn't an education debt. This is actually a debt with the Australian Tax Office. It's linked to your tax file number, and there's evidence to suggest that it prevents young people from starting a business and purchasing houses and building a family. So what you need now is you need to build a plan and recognise whether a tertiary education actually fits within that plan, or starting work young, straight out of school, finish year 12, great grades, getting out into the working world and experience what it offers and look for opportunities within it. That's how many of the nation's entrepreneurs today started.
Not everyone wants to be an entrepreneur, but you are suggesting that some people might consider doing that and then going back and doing the degree a little later on.
Absolutely.
When you really know what you're interested in.
Yeah, absolutely. And I did it when I'm 40. I went back to university at 40. I never went when I was young. And it was a real eye-opener for me. It was actually a catalyst to write the book. But you find your way because your natural trajectory takes you there. What you have to understand is you've got to put on your boss's boots and look at their situation and look at what they need. And they need people. They have a demand for a skill, and they need people that are going to match that skill, and you've got to be able to prove that you can't let your boss down. And that's certainly another problem for young people today, because they've been a little transient, they've hopped from job to job, and they're difficult to skill up, and we have many employers today a little bit reluctant to hire young Australians.
That's an interesting point, because, you know, we're encouraged now to, you know, try different things, move from, you know, no job is going to be permanent. No longer will people have 20-year jobs with the same employer. What are they doing differently in Germany and Switzerland that's really struck a chord with you?
Yeah, look, they're very big on what I call in my book the parallel pathway. They call it dual-track training. And they work with an employer 3 to 4 days a week, and go to school 1 to 2 days a week. And this starts as young as 15 and 16. In Austria, for instance...
Is that just for the less academically inclined kids, or is it everyone?
No, look, there's a different tier of education there. There's almost three streams, and I'm trying to match Switzerland and Germany a little bit different, and I don't want to go into the complexities of both of them. But in a nutshell, they are ranked a little bit at school. To the less academic, to the most academic, and then the middle academic finds themselves in this dual track pathway, working with employers. And the most important thing to recognise when you're in this system is that an employer needs to meet their customers' needs now. So the on the job training is relevant and current now. Unlike often university and what you're learning, it's a little bit outdated by the time you get into the working world, because it's been created, you know, 2 or 3 years earlier.
Interesting point. Let's take a final call. Lawrence in New South Wales. Good morning
to you.
You'd like to make a point about the Youth Connections program.
Yes, I was quite horrified. I'm a retired businessman. In business, we used to put all our efforts into successful programs. Things that worked, we put more emphasis into. Things that didn't work, we either fixed them or closed them down. But the Abbott government came in and they basically closed down the Youth Connections Partnerships program, which was a very, very successful program according to all the reports. And they said they wanted to bring back the Work for the Dole scheme, which by most reports was a major failure. My great sadness is the government's going against what business does. They should reverse this, and the people who are listening should look up Youth Connections and bring up the members of parliament and say the government should go with what works, not try and muck around with things that don't work. But the other thing that I would like to see is your expert here said something about getting the wages lower. I think there's a real opportunity here. If yes, the wages went lower, but the government topped up the wages of the employer. So then we need to get people training, because they can't get jobs without experience. They should work on problems to give them experience.
Lawrence, thank you very much for the call. And that's where we have to wrap. Peter, this is we could talk for a whole hour on this. I can see it now. But it's a vital, vital topic, isn't it?
Oh, look, absolutely. And Lawrence is passionate, and you can see it. And many people are passionate about this issue, you know. But look, my final message to parents, it's time to make some tough decisions. And this problem isn't going away. It's about prevention. And prevention, you know, needs to start in the early teenage years and with a plan and a pathway, and ideally a dual-track pathway that combines education and workforce skills. That's the answer.
Thank you, Peter Koronica. Appreciate the time. And we got some good calls. We could probably pick it up again on Life Matters, I hope. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Natasha, for having me on the show.
And Peter Koronica's new book is Your Boss's Boots, How to Get Your Foot Through the Door in the Competitive World of Work. And we'll pop the details of it on the Life Matters website if you'd like to find out more. Thank you for the calls. Keep talking on our Facebook page, our listener feedback line, 02833 1430. Up next, let's dance.
A new segment this week on the Sunday Extra podcast, George Brandis Explains Things. Well, not really, but we do have a crack at making sense of metadata and data retention. Effective tools in the war on terror? Our On the Contrary debaters look at bigotry, outsiders, and a peek inside the mysterious world of the Japanese Love Hotel. Join me, Jonathan Green. You can stream or download the program from the RN website.
And I must say, lots of text messages and also tweets on our last discussion, so keep it alive. And so do U-turns. We take them in our lives from time to time. And sometimes work, when we're young, can do that for us too. A single decision turns a day around or changes your life completely. If you're based in regional Australia, ABC Open is your opportunity to get creative through writing or film or photography, all in the interests of bringing your stories alive. And their ongoing 500 Words project, where essentially the ABC Open team picks a theme a month, you write a true story around that theme, 500 words. And recently they considered the U-turns we take in life. Contributor Nicole Knight mused about her time as a young ballerina and a piece of advice that stayed with her long after she hung up her points. Here she is.
I love to dance. I think most of life's problems can be solved or alleviated through shaking your body around to music. This theory has been backed up time and again by popular culture. From Footloose to Pharrell's Happy, dancing makes everything bad bearable and everything good great. But there was a time where my love for dancing was nearly crushed under the weight of competition. Like most aspiring ballerinas, I reached the stage where those who were serious began to compete. I was among the good dancers at my ballet school, and I thrived on perfecting my turnout and tendus. I wanted to be the best. I was at a big state competition and warming up backstage. I remember the smell of hairspray, the silky touch of pink ribbons, the lick of Revlon red lipstick across my mouth, and looking at my 13-year-old face, staring seriously back at me through the light bulb lined mirror. My palms were sweaty, my head fuzzy, and my heart heavy. I wasn't psyched up to perform. I was completely psyched out. I had been listening to all the other girls talk in whispers that my best friend was a sure thing to win. My friend was an excellent dancer, but I knew I was just as good. And I couldn't help but feel, if her victory was guaranteed, then what was the point of even trying? Why wasn't I being whispered about? What did she have that I didn't? I was stuck, cycling between envy and feelings of worthlessness. It was the first time that had ever really gotten to me. And looking around my life today, it's sad because I see women experiencing this all the time. Feeling like we're not good enough because of the constant comparisons, measuring ourselves by others and wanting to be better than the next girl. My mother, seeing my distress, took me outside. I explained while blinking back tears what was going on. I can't remember her exact words to me, but it was the simple and obvious encouragement to forget about what everyone else is doing and go out there and dance for you. Letting her words sink in, I made the decision to do just that. And it felt fantastic. I didn't care about who was judging me or where I ranked. I soaked up the stage lights and threw my soul into every movement. It was exhilarating and freeing. I changed my view of my friends, and instead of seeing them as competition, I saw them as comrades. I will never forget turning my mindset around. My U-turn.
What a beautiful piece. Thank you, Nicole Knight, reading her story for the 500 Words Project. On the theme of U-turn, and that's run through ABC Open, the piece was produced by Ben Tupaz, who I think is based in Toowoomba, part of the ABC Open team, and Ian Walker, with help from Lila Shunner. And this month's theme, if you live in regional Australia, get on ABC Open's website, 500 Words Project. 500 words on the theme of right here, right now. Check out open.abc.net.au. Yes. Now, you're on Life Matters. Natasha Mitchell with you this morning. And we're getting theatrical, but in a setting that you wouldn't normally anticipate. That's coming up.
Yes, we won gold in Glasgow for sport, but meanwhile, our scientists were coming first in Britain as well.
The Gardens of London were at Hampton Court Palace Flower Show. We put on an Australian garden with Royal Botanic Gardens pulling it together, and we won not only gold medal, but best in show.
Gold for Australia, the botanist Tim Entwistle in the science show. And we shall also ask why Hobart is a world centre for bomb detection. Truly. An explosive science show which you'll find down there at the RN website.
The art of listening, it's a skill, that's for sure, one that is vital for successful communication and relationships, and one of the most important relationships you'll likely have in your life, even if it's a fleeting relationship, is that with your doctor or your surgeon or your nurse. Vital. And a play called Hear Me is helping to highlight how medical errors arise from miscommunication and so much else besides. It's all sort of part of an approach called health plays. Dr. Catherine Crock is a physician in haematology at the Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne, I think. Is that right?
That's right.
That's right. And you're also executive director of the Australian Institute for Patient and Family-Centred Care. This is your brainchild, something of a thespian too, I think. Hear me.
Yes.
Hear me. I mean, those two words at the top of this play, so vital in a healthcare setting.
Yes, they are, really, Natasha. The play came out of years of thinking and interacting with patients and families. And in my own work at the Royal Children's Hospital, I've learned what value we can get from listening, really attentive listening, I'd call it, and connecting in a very human person-to-person way with the patients and families and also with your own colleagues.
Mm. Listening and then doing on the basis of what you've heard, I guess. I mean, miscommunication can have extremely serious consequences in a hospital environment. Can you just give us a sense of what can go wrong when the communication falls down?
Natasha, there are just so many things that can go wrong, and I think if we come back to the basics of respecting people and respecting what people have got to tell us about their experience, I think we can really make the care a lot safer. So I can give you a small example.
Yes.
When I'm working with families at the Children's, I like to let the parents know exactly how important their role is in helping us to get their child the best possible care. So when families come, they often don't understand that role. So I'll explain to them that they are part of the team and they're part of the safety of everything we do. And if they're even the slightest bit unsure, we'd like them to speak up and tell us. So we need to make the environment safe enough for people to be able to speak and tell us what they're worried about.
Mm-hmm.
So I do lumbar puncture tests and give chemotherapy to children. The very beginning of the journey, the parents are overwhelmed with all the information. If we carefully bring them into the team and help them along, they can be such wonderful allies to us. So one day I was about to do a lumbar puncture on a child, and
a thankless task, really, isn't it?
Well, in some ways it's really inspiring because the families are just so amazing. I was about to do a lumbar puncture and then give some chemotherapy, and I showed the mother the chemotherapy order. And she just said, no, stop, that's not the right order. Now, what had happened some long time before, the child had had seizures when she'd had this chemotherapy. Mm. The mother knew that, but somebody had forgotten to document it. So a very simple miscommunication in the documentation. Further down the track, two doctors sign off the chemotherapy. The pharmacists check it as well. Mm. The only person in the chain who can stop that error is the mother, because she's been there at every step of the way. And if we don't listen to her and if we don't respect her input, then bad things can happen and it's unnecessary.
Miscommunication leading to medical error. And that's one example, but I imagine there are countless examples and small errors and catastrophic errors.
Yes, so when we were thinking about how do we get this message across to health professionals and to patients and families, the Australian Institute for Patient and Family-Centred Care decided we'd collect stories. So we talked to families, we talked to patients, and we also talked to frontline staff to gather everybody's perspective on this situation.
Now, you also, though, point to, yes, communication is vital, but there's something else that's wrapped around that communication in hospitals, and that's a particular traditional culture that sort of manifests in a hierarchy of operating. How can that also get in the way? Because this is part of what you're addressing too.
Yes, the hierarchy and the way healthcare has developed over many years can contribute. If people, once again, it's about feeling listened to, feeling that you have a voice and that you can speak up if you're worried about something. And it's pretty common that junior staff are not in that situation and don't necessarily feel that they can speak without impacting on their career.
Because the surgeons are seen as God.
Well,
in some sense, to put it bluntly.
There are lots of people in the system, exactly, who are more senior and supposedly have more knowledge.
Mm. And so to the idea of a health play, and I'm intrigued to hear how audiences are responding, because your audiences are some of these people in the health hierarchy. Tell us about why you thought theatre might penetrate the consciousness of health workers.
Well, I was looking for a slightly more creative way to get some messages across. And over the years, I've worked a lot with music in health through the Hush Collection, music that calms patients and families and staff. And I saw that as a non-threatening way, maybe, to be able to talk about some of these deeper messages and really important, worrying messages. And so the use of story and narrative, really, instead of PowerPoint presentations, I thought
death
might
by
be
PowerPoint. Pun not intended. But this all came and then about through, you've collaborated with the well-known playwright Alan Hopgood and actor,
well,
of course.
Alan is just brilliant, and we've had a marvellous time working on this project. I'd seen that Alan had done other plays about healthcare, about prostate, about diabetes, about specific disease categories, really. And I thought maybe we could come up with something that was really creative and innovative and exciting for staff and patients to hear about patient-centred care and patient safety.
So let's hear an excerpt of, well, the play, the current play, Hear Me.
Well, Lily had a severe stomach upset. Shocking. Vomiting, cramps. Oh, it was terrible. And there was nothing I could do that seemed to help her. It just came out of the blue. She'd always been a good girl, you know, sensible, as far as I knew. She'd been in a relationship for about a year or so, but, well, that had ended. So she'd come home to Mum.
How old was she?
23. When the vomiting got really bad, I couldn't take her to the doctors because it was after hours. And then when she went on vomiting, I got worried that she'd get dehydrated. So I took her to casualty. They said it was an appendix, and I said, well, she's not pregnant. You know, that was the first thing I asked her, and she said no. So they admitted her and said she'd be put on a drip to keep her hydrated.
And did they?
They must have, because that's what killed her.
Oh, goodness me. Catherine Crock, is a real scenario, isn't it, that you're feeding into this play?
Yes, well, we've fed a whole lot of scenarios into the play. They're all de-identified. This is never about blaming anybody for something that's gone wrong. It's more a case of how can we look really carefully at what the communication was and what the setting was that made this go wrong so that it doesn't ever happen again.
And what happened in this situation?
So in this situation, a young lady comes in with her mother and she's been vomiting, she's put on a drip, and the wrong amount of medication is put into that drip by one of the junior doctors. Now, the junior doctor is queried by one of the nurses, but she feels awkward about taking that advice. She certainly wasn't going to go to her superior because he'd humiliated her on numerous occasions about mistakes. She actually gives a beautiful speech about how that made her feel, how it paralyzes her and she can't make decisions because the culture hasn't made her feel safe when she's a bit worried about things. And at first, Alan and I thought we could write a comedy. The issues are actually too serious for that, and we wanted people to think long and hard about their interactions with each other as staff members and interactions with the patients and families.
Yes, and I can really see how kind of play acting a scenario instead of actually debriefing about a real scenario can allow for all sorts of conversations to happen. So what sort of conversations coming up after a scenario like that on stage? Because this is what it's about for you, isn't it? This is the evaluation process is key and what people get talking about.
It's been very exciting, actually, and we didn't expect such a response. So we've put the play on now in 65 hospitals and at a whole series of conferences. So around 5,000 people have seen it.
Blimey.
And the conversations are about, we really didn't realise how our own communication could be so important. Some of the nursing staff say, we're so mean to each other. Why are we treating each other like this when we're trying to do our best in our workplace? People talk about how they realise now they haven't maybe taken enough account of patient experiences and what really matters to the families when they have a loved one who's sick in hospital. But when you talked about executives seeing it, I think the effect there has been quite profound. So it's executives and we've shown it to the Department of Health in Victoria, to their senior staff. And as soon as the play finishes, the conversation is about, goodness, that's what it was like when my mother was sick and I took her into the emergency department and we just felt frustrated that we weren't listened to. Mm. Or we hear stories about how well it can go when you do feel that your input is valued.
Mm. But, you know, here was an example of a situation where a junior doctor didn't feel confident to be questioned by a nurse, for example, didn't feel probably confident enough to talk to a senior physician. And that's a fundamental cultural change that's required. That's about status and ego. Are the plays chipping away at those issues?
That's what I think we are doing. So we're opening up some of these discussions. And what I've found personally quite amazing is to have 200 people in the room and they're talking about some of these difficult cultural things and how we do need to make a change.
Have you shown it to the wider public, or is this really about health professionals?
We would like to show it to the general public. So we've had a small number of general public come to each performance and their contribution to the discussion is fantastic. So I think there would be an opportunity to show it more widely. Because I think part of the discussion is where do the patients and families fit into this and how important is their role, and if they're empowered to know that they can speak up when they're worried, that will make a difference as well.
Dr. Catherine Crock, have there been moments where you've just gone, oh, yes, this is working? Are there interactions after this play where you've just gone, oh, we've nailed it?
Yes, I think you're right about that. Certainly having medical students in the audience, sometimes they've just said something priceless about how they've observed things happening to the people a couple of years above them that they now will think about really carefully when they're in that situation.
Mm.
So well, I think changing it from the bottom up and also from the top down is going to be much better and much more satisfying healthcare experience for the patients, the families and for the people working there.
Okay, but a play is one thing. How are you actually evaluating whether it's translating into behavioural change?
So we've collected the feedback from all of the people who've seen the play. About 80% of people have actually responded to us. We write down all the comments that are said in those discussions. Everything's de-identified. We hand out a little postcard to everyone who attends, and it asks them two main things. What are a couple of things you think this healthcare organisation could do to improve? And what are two things that you personally can do to improve your interactions in healthcare? So we're asking people to own it and personalise it. And we're giving all of that information back to the hospitals so that they can respond to it and continue these conversations that we've got started. Now, we've already heard from some places that changes are happening. Some places have now started a much more robust patient-centred care, patient-centred campaign with the actual families involved in their hospitals. One hospital is going to put a recorded message on the phone so that when junior doctors ring people late at night, and I remember that feeling myself, you're sitting there in terror thinking, can I ring somebody senior at 2 a.m. and ask them a question?
Yeah.
If you had a recorded message on the phone saying, this call will be recorded for education and training purposes, the hospital is thinking that will subtly change the way those phone calls are carried on at night.
Yeah, that's a fantastic idea, isn't it? I'll be interested to see whether this theatre-led revolution has an impact when we all end up in hospital and have to negotiate these sorts of connections and relationships. Congratulations on the work, Dr. Catherine Kroc. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Natasha.
Catherine is a physician in haematology. She's at the Melbourne Royal Children's Hospital, Executive Director of the Australian Institute for Patient and Family-Centred Care. And we'll pop the details of the play on the Life Matters website. It's called Hear Me. And you wanted to be heard in relation to our talk back at the top of the show about whether or not kids are missing out on work experience, paid work experience, how vital that is to curbing youth unemployment. The figures are extremely high. I'll just read a couple of text messages that we got in. Let kids be kids, but let's face it, they grow up really quickly. My 9 and 6-year-olds are in a different mindset to when my wife and I were kids, and most parents we talk to feel the same. Joe has texted, I disagree that getting a job is somehow robbing children of childhood. From around 14, all of my siblings got jobs, from babysitting, picking fruit, working in corner stores, etc., and it teaches independence, punctuality, presentation, courtesy with customers and the boss, etc., that will be useful whatever you do in the future. Mum and Dad always encouraged paid work and team sport. None of us have ever been without work. Not always a dream job, but an autonomy that you can't beat. Thank you very much, Joe, and thank you for all your tweets and text messages. 0283 1430 is our listener feedback line number. You can ring any time, or you can email us or comment on our website. Next on Life Matters, Jess Irvine is popping in for our Everyday Economics segment, talking pregonomics, the economics of pregnancy. We're also going to meet a direct Indigenous descendant of the only survivor from the original Burkham Wills expedition. How's that? Can't wait for that. Coming up to the news here on RN. Bye from me.
segment this week on the Sunday Extra podcast, George Brandis Explains Things. Well, not really, but we do have a crack at making sense of metadata and data retention. Effective tools in the war on terror? Our on-the-contrary debaters look at bigotry, outsiders, and a peek inside the mysterious world of the Japanese Love Hotel. Join me, Jonathan Green. You can stream or download the program from the RN website.